to the Veterans Breakfast Club on this last day of winter. My name is Todd DePastino. I'm the Executive Director of the Veterans Breakfast Club. This is a program that we have been calling the VBC Happy Hour for several years now. Somebody pointed out to me that on the Eastern time zone, it's a little too late for a happy hour. We don't do any drinking on this program. It's not an hour, it's 90 minutes. And that maybe we should change the name. So because our Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, is with us today, we are going to christen from here on this program, the Scuttlebutt. Call it the Scuttlebutt. And as you know, we've been doing a Scuttlebutt podcast. This will be released as a podcast. We're kind of shifting the Scuttlebutt podcast, I guess you could say, to Monday night. So I'm Todd DePastino. This is the Veterans Breakfast Club. I'm the executive director of this nonprofit based here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that has been gathering veterans together to share stories for 15 years, since 2008. We talk about all things related to the military community, past and present. And, you know, our programs, we, as a nonprofit, we see our programs as connecting, educating, healing, and inspiring. And we welcome everybody to join us. You don't have to be a veteran to hear the stories or ask questions or participate in our programs. You could go to veteransbreakfastclub.org if you're not familiar with what we do and learn more about what we do and become a member if you'd like. We'd always love to have you join us anytime. We have sponsors that we greatly value, UPMC for Life and also Tobacco Free Adagio Health. I'll be talking about them a little later in the program, but right now I want to introduce our guest tonight, Secretary Ray Mabus, who served as Secretary of the Navy from 2009 to 2017. That's the longest tenure as Secretary of the Navy since the famous Josephus Daniels during World War I. Secretary Mabus was also Governor of Mississippi prior to that and Ambassador to Saudi Arabia and also Auditor. You were Auditor General of Mississippi.
An elected position.
An elected position, even though you're not an accountant.
Right. And in 4 years, the FBI and I put almost 20% of all local officials in jail for corruption.
Holy mackerel. That's a whole nother story. You are also a Navy veteran. You served as a surface warfare officer on the USS Little Rock, a light cruiser.
Guided missile light cruiser. Yeah.
Guided missile light cruiser. And so we thought we would have Secretary Mabus, who you might notice he's feeling under the weather, but he has very graciously decided to tough it out and hang with us here for an hour as long as he can. And I thought we'd have Secretary Mabus talk about his Navy career and surface warfare officer. And also, of course, his long tenure, 8-year tenure with as Secretary of the Navy. I do want to point out that we have our esteemed VIP, very important person, World War II Navy Wave, Julia Parsons with us, joining us as she always has. I thank you, Julia. I'm going to ask you to unmute if you'd like and say hello to Secretary Mabus. Hi, Julia.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. How are you?
Oh, I'm just fine. Thank you. Really good. Yes, I remember his name. Unfortunately, I don't remember the face. But that was not one of those things, I guess. I don't think that we saw faces as much in those days as we do now, certainly.
Julia, you didn't miss a thing.
Well, I did tell him a little bit about you, Julia. And I told him and others who are on the program who don't know Julia, Julia just celebrated her 103rd birthday on March 2nd. And not only that, but she will be featured as part of a new big exhibit on women in history here at the Senator John Hines History Center, which is the big history museum here in Western Pennsylvania in the Pittsburgh area. Julia, some of her artifacts and some of her documents. I think an Enigma machine is going to be on display. So Julia, do you have any plans to go down to the History Center when the exhibit opens?
Well, I guess I have to, don't I?
I guess you do.
I'm you sure know. I do, and I will. I'm sure Sue will take me, so well, I'm not sure of that.
Well, my thought, Julia, and we're going to get to Secretary Mavis. Don't, we're going to get to, you're just second VIP here, Secretary Mavis, behind Julia. My thought was to have you come down on March 29th, Vietnam Veterans Day, because the exhibit opens on the 23rd. We're going to open the door to the History Museum early before our Vietnam Veterans Day program. And encourage people to, before the our program starts, encourage people to tour the exhibit and see your stuff. So I thought it would be fun to have you, you know, down there with us, and maybe at the beginning of our program, let people know that they're there in the audience and they could come and have their pictures taken with you and stuff like that, if that's agreeable to you.
Yeah, what time is that?
We'll say 5 o'clock, 5 p.m.
Yeah, that would be fine.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Julia. Thank you for joining us tonight. And okay, Secretary Mavis, thank you also for joining us tonight. You come from Mississippi.
Yes.
I guess there's some Navy in Mississippi, right? Mobile?
Mobile is in Alabama.
Oh.
but.
I'm so embarrassed. Okay.
The biggest employer in Mississippi is Ingalls, which builds half of all our destroyers and all of our amphibs. The Navy Seabees are headquartered on our Gulf Coast, and our SEALs do some training in riverine tactics.
So how did you get into the Navy? What was your path?
I did ROTC at Ole Miss when I was there. My dad had been in the Navy in World War II, and my dad, not just the Navy, but thought it was important to serve. And so when, and I was an only child, I told Todd, my father was almost 50 when I was born, and I revered him. And if he thought going into the Navy was a good idea, so did I.
Did he give you any advice?
No, just serve. Just figure out a way to serve. And so I did ROTC. I went through Ole Miss in 3 years, so I did my summer cruise after I graduated. And was commissioned in the summer. I was commissioned in the summer of 69. The Navy gave me a year off to go to graduate school, and I joined USS Little Rock in 1970. And the only thing I'll correct you about, I was not a surface warfare officer, because that was before there was a designator for surface warfare officers.
Oh, they didn't exist at the time.
Didn't exist.
Huh.
It pilots had their wings, submariners had their dolphins, surface officers were just black shoe sailors,
and that was
and when I became secretary, they put on the website that I had been a surface warfare officer, and I said, you know, you probably ought to take that down. I really wasn't, but the first ship I visited, they had a ceremony and made me a surface warfare officer with absolutely no gain in technical skill. But I have my designator now framed in my home.
And I assume, since you went on to become a Secretary of the Navy, that the Navy was a good experience for you.
The Navy was an amazing experience for me. I was 21 years old. All of a sudden, I was in charge of 60 people. I tell folks I was their mother, their father, their priest, their rabbi, their banker, their psychiatrist. And I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I was saved by the same thing that most junior officers are saved by, which was a great chief, Chief Finney, kept me from, you know, just really messing up too badly. But, you know, you learn responsibility, you learn accountability. And, you know, when you're, we were, I qualified as an OD and a fleet OD. And, you know, when you're sailing in formation at night with a carrier and five or six other ships, you better be paying attention. And you better know what your job is and know how to do it. And I want to, I'm derelict in getting this far in without recognizing Julia Parsons. You know, I'm in awe of a couple of things, is how far you've made it, but the stuff you've done along the way. And I know you were in crypto. That was one of my jobs on the Little Rock, the cruiser that was I was on. I was the crypto officer. And you're one of the reasons we won. So thank you so much. And I know some of the uphill climbs that women faced at the time before you got on. I told Todd that my mother was an auditor for the Marines in Washington during World War II, and loved the Marine Corps all her life. And I think, you know, given the opportunity or figuring out that she had the opportunity, she would have loved to have been in service. So anyway, but that was my, my Navy experience. I was, I'm not sure that any of the things I've been fortunate enough to do would have happened had I not spent that time in the Navy. It was that meaningful, that transformative to me and to my life.
We have a Navy veteran on here in the Zoom room with us, a friend of mine, Chad Riddle, who was in the Navy around the same time you were, also a young officer, very young. And he has said on our program that everybody should be an ensign once in their life. And I think you could say, you know, the second lieutenant, first lieutenant, once in your life, where you're put in a position of responsibility and having to lead others, not knowing much, and being, you know, kind of being coached from above and from below in the job. And I just imagine you came out of that 2 years. It really was 2 years on the Little Rock, I believe, correct? A changed person.
I did. I really did. And as everybody on this call knows, the U.S. military pushes responsibility down further and faster than any other organization I've ever seen. They make you absolutely responsible, absolutely accountable. And the story that I tell from my time as secretary was when the tsunami hit Japan, Tomodachi, we had the Ronald Reagan going by Japan on its way to do combat air over Afghanistan. And we turned the Reagan in about 2 hours and sent it to do humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. And they used exactly the same tools and techniques to get the right thing in the right order to the right place at the right time that they were going to use in combat over Afghanistan. And when I went out to visit the Reagan, a little over 2 weeks later, after the exercise was over. And, you know, a secretary is a flag magnet. So when you show up, every admiral in a 1,000-mile radius comes to get some face time. But in this, I was in their combat suite, and the, you know, admirals, captains everywhere, but the people briefing me were a lieutenant, junior grade, and a petty officer, second class, because they were the ones that had run the operation. They were the ones that had planned it. and that it seen that it was executed correctly. So yeah, I did come out. I had a great childhood, a great upbringing, but all of a sudden, as you said, you were absolutely accountable. And it's sort of like throwing you into the deep end, and you got to swim. And you learn a whole lot, particularly if you listen to senior enlisted like your chiefs.
Yeah, a lot of responsibility at a very young age. And it's not just responsibility for expensive equipment, but also for lives and livelihood and nothing less than national security. So it's just something that I've learned time and again from our veterans is the amount of responsibility they took on at a very, very young age. No doubt that helped to prepare you for what you did at a young age, becoming governor of Mississippi, holding other offices. Was becoming Secretary of the Navy something that you had wanted, envisioned for yourself? Or is it one of those things where like new administration comes in and there's this opening and you're kind of seen as a good fit?
Door number one. I had endorsed Barack Obama in March of 07. And there weren't many white guys who'd been governor of a deep southern state who did. And I went out and did 300 events for him in 28 different states. And when the campaign was over with, I didn't do it to get a job, but I just went home to Mississippi. And after a few weeks, somebody from the transition called me, somebody I knew pretty well, and said, would you like to come into the administration? And I said, well, depends on the job. And they said, well, we've got some ideas. Do you have anything in mind? And I said, yeah, I want to be Secretary of the Navy. and they said, okay, well, what's your second choice? And I said, I don't have a second choice. If you want me to be Secretary of the Navy, I would love to do that. But otherwise, I got a pretty good life going in Mississippi. I'll just wish you guys well. I found out later, about a year after I became secretary, that Secretary of the Navy was the most requested position in the Obama administration.
Why would that be?
Because it's the coolest job on earth.
I mean, I don't want to act too surprised, but Secretary of the Navy, I mean, used to, of course, be a cabinet position back before the Department of Defense and, you know, 1947 or so. I think that does the Secretary of the Navy reports to the Secretary of Defense, I would think. So it's no longer considered a...
Sort of,
okay. The Commander of Naval Operations and then the Commandant of the Marine Corps report to the Secretary of the Navy. Why is it the coolest job?
A whole bunch of reasons. Number one, both Roosevelts were assistant secretary. The only country beside the U.S. that's ever had this job was England, first Lord of the Admiralty, and Churchill had the job twice.
Okay.
That's a pretty good history.
You're selling it. You're selling it.
But, you know, you've got both, you've got everything. You've got land, sea, and air. You've got the biggest line item in the federal budget because you've got two services. Our biggest discretionary line item. So I had 1 million people reporting to me. I had about a $200 billion budget every year and worldwide responsibilities. And you can have a lot of impact doing that. And just the history, the heritage of the naval services, I think, I apologize for you Army and Air Force veterans on here, but I did ask how many people asked to be Secretary of the Army? None. How many people asked to be Secretary of the Air Force? None. And so it really is recognized has just this incredible job. But, you know, the other thing about it, the Secretary of Defense now, that's the cabinet official, is such a policy position now. I mean, they spend half their time at the White House and principals meetings and stuff like that. If you're a service secretary, you're an operator. You actually get things done. You get to make real decisions. And I mean, on the cool factor side, I mean, I stood on both poles. I've flown in every Navy Marine Corps aircraft. You know, I've gone twice the speed of sound. I've been underway on a submarine for 6 days. You know, when I left, I was the most traveled senior executive in U.S. government history, 1,342,544 miles, 152 different countries. And that counted Afghanistan as one. And I went there 12 times, went to Japan 10, went to Australia 8. And we were doing something with all those 152 countries or territories. We have Marines in more than 40 countries. We have SEALs in more than 40 countries. We have Marine Guards in every country that has a U.S. embassy. And so the reach was just incredible. And you know, the wow factor was incredible, and the just the fun part of the job was incredible. But it's a hard job, and it wears you out physically if you do it right. Because I decided to go see sailors and Marines where they were, instead of waiting on the off chance they might come see me at the Pentagon. So I would go to ships, bases, do all hands calls. And if I missed shaking a sailor or a Marine's hand during my 8 years there, I mean, every one of their hands, something was wrong, because I really, really tried. And the last thing I'll say, and then get back to your question, my staff figured out pretty early that if I was having a bad day, or if I just was tired or jet lagged or something, that if they really wanted to get me going in a positive direction, just put me with some sailors or Marines.
Yeah.
And suddenly everything, you know, I got a lot better.
It does sound like a one of a kind job, 152 countries. 30, you threw out first pitches at 30 different major league baseball team stadiums.
I did. And I, by the way, I went to all 50 states too. The Secretary of the Navy gets to name every Navy ship. There is no process. There is no committee. You just name it. And, wow. I was naming, you know, ships in states or cities, at the state capitol or the city hall. And it was great. You know, the governor would usually come, and we'd have a Navy band. There'd be 300 or 400 people. And we were going to St. Louis. I was going to name the USS St. Louis. And I just asked my travel team, I said, are the Cardinals in town? Because I grew up a Cardinals fan, it being the only Southern team at the time. And they looked and said, yeah. And I said, well, could I name it at the Cardinals game? And so Navy's got a pretty good, you know, public relations team. And so they did a film for the Jumbotron about what this ship was going to look like, about how long it would be in the fleet. And so I named it there, and they asked me if I wanted to throw out the first pitch. And, you know, that was like, is this a trick question? Yes. And so instead of 300 people, all of a sudden I had 40,000 people that knew about this ship. And I thought one of my jobs was to connect the Navy and Marine Corps with the people they defended. because I call my nickname for the Navy Marine Corps was America's Away Team, because when they were doing their job, they were usually a long way from home and people didn't see how good they were, how dangerous the jobs were, how effective they were at doing it. And so I named, and it just sort of happened. I named a lot of cities, you know, I named the Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Oakland, the Cincinnati, but I would go to baseball stadiums and swear people in, or re-enlist people, just again, to try to make that connection. And the only tough one was Toronto, because I wasn't Secretary of the Canadian Navy. And so the Canadian Chief of Navy and I threw out simultaneous first pitches to show our partnership. I also named a ship the Cooperstown after the Baseball Hall of Fame, because 39 members of the Hall of Fame served, mainly in World War II. You know, Ted Williams was a Marine pilot in both World War II and Korea, Jerry Coleman in Korea, and Bob Feller. And we also stood up, while I was secretary, the Bob Feller Act of Valor Award, because Bob Feller, the day after Pearl Harbor, drove from Cleveland to Norfolk and enlisted in the Navy and served all 4 years. Now, he was on the USS Alabama, a battleship, and got 8 battle stars during World War II. And when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, he still won more than 260 games, missing 4 years at the heart of his career. He was asked what his most memorable victory was, and he said World War II.
Yeah. And you know, connecting, having the public connect to the military community is harder today than it was in Bob Feller's day, or even in your day when you were on the USS Little Rock. Our military is smaller, so much smaller than it had been in previous generations. And so that kind of connecting is one of the missions of our organization. And I think there really does need to be this constant effort to encourage people like me to learn from veterans and service. I wanted to talk about some of your priorities and accomplishments as Secretary of the Navy. We have another board member, Colonel Brad Washabaugh, retired U.S. Marine Corps. How are you, Brad?
Very well. I'm so in awe of our guest and the opportunity to have you on our show tonight, sir. And thank you for taking the time to do that. And, you know, I put a couple questions in the chat, but I have to lead off with the obvious one, because a Marine doesn't get the chance to ask this question of a former Secretary of the Navy. You know, as Marines, you know, we always get the rub that we understand the Marines are just part of the Navy. Then you have to explain the whole Department of the Navy. And then you got to say those things you can't say that aren't politically correct about, you know, those men's department and everything like that. But how come we can't change the Department of the Navy to the Department of the Navy and Marine Corps?
You know, there was a bill in 2 or 3 times when I was secretary to do just that. And they asked me about it. And my response was, I don't care what the name is, as long as you let me run it. The Marines are the most iconic service that we have. I mean, if you're looking for a good brand, the Marines have it. And I really don't know. I've often thought that myself. It may date back to, you know, the Department of the Navy was established in 1797. I was the third longest secretary since then, serving secretary since then. And they just, I don't know, did it then and have not seen a reason to change it.
Well, we do a pretty good job of our own PR, so the name change isn't absolutely necessary, but it was a question I just couldn't resist asking you, sir, and thanks for that.
And you know, it's like a parent. I love all my children equally, and Navy and Marine Corps, you know, I couldn't imagine one without the other.
And then it's a good question is why the Navy over the Marine Corps? Your mother had experience with the Marines. Did she tell some bad stories over dinner table, or what happened there?
Well, my dad was in the Navy, so it was a mixed marriage. No, frankly, the reason I went Navy instead of Marines, because you had the Marine option coming out of ROTC. I sort of wanted a warm place to sleep and hot food.
Well, you got that, so,
Yeah,
but thank you.
we had a mar dead on my ship, and I got to know the Marines. I lived right down from the Marine locker. My stateroom was 10 feet down a passageway from the Marine locker, and I got to know the Marines pretty well during that time. But I'll repeat your words. I'm all in awe of anybody that can go through and become a Marine. I'm frankly not sure I could have.
Thank you, sir. I guess if you have time, I had another question. How does the Department of the Navy determine the number of ships and the types of ships? I know that could be a complicated question, really involved, but I always wonder with the different threats and the strategies, how do you get to that final mix?
Every 4 years, you do a thing called a force structure assessment that looks at the threats, looks at the world, and says, this is how many ships we need. The one that was done right before I came in was, it said we needed 308 ships. And that was what I was building toward. The one when I left 8 years later said we needed 355. And let me say a couple more things about both those. In 2001, right before 9/11, the US Navy had 316 ships. When I came in 8 years later, the Navy had 271 ships. Over that 8 years, only 41 ships had been put under contract. And 41 ships, if we kept going at that pace, so about five ships built a year, our fleet was going to get below 200 ships. And our shipyards weren't going to stay in business. So in my 8 years, instead of 41, we built 87. And with a smaller top line. I mean, my dad was the cheapest human who ever lived. And I'm his son. I tried to drive as hard a bargain as I could and still be fair to shipbuilders. But you know what the needs are. And one of the reasons I tried to build as many ships as I did was we simply didn't have enough ships to do all the jobs the nation wanted us to. So we were keeping ships out way too long. We were extending deployments way too long. I mean, when I was in the early 70s, we knew the day we were going to leave and we knew the day we were going to come back. Some of the carrier strike groups and amphibious ready groups would stay out 9, 10 months, which is just really hard on sailors, Marines. And so you know what the need is, but then you got to convince Congress. Well, first you've got to convince the administration to get it in the budget. And then you've got to convince Congress that of the need. I'll give you two examples of things we did. As I said, Huntington Ingalls builds half of all our destroyers. Bath Iron Works builds the other half. And we were doing two destroyers a year. And so they were taking it as an allocation. And we didn't want to lose either shipyard. And they both had pretty powerful congressional delegations. But early on, instead of bidding out two, we bid out three. And we said, low bid gets the third ship. And oh, by the way, if the high bid has to match the low bid's number, or they don't get any ships. And Bath crushed Pascagoula. I mean, just did them in. The next year we bid out 10 and said, low bid gets six. With the same rules, high bid has to meet the low bid's number. Pascagoula crushed Bath a year later. And so we, excuse me, I'm about to sneeze. We saved $300 million per ship, per destroyer, by doing that. The second example is we convinced Congress to do a multi-year buy on Virginia class attack submarines. And so we bought 10 over 5 years, two subs a year. And they're about $2 billion each then, they were. And we got 10 for $18 billion. Now, this is math in public, but $2 billion a sub times 10 subs doesn't give you 18 billion. We got one sub free for doing it because the shipbuilder could know how many people to hire, know how much training to give, know how they could do economic order quantity on materials. And so I used to carry a little thing around. I said, it's like buy nine subs, get your 10th sub free. And by driving it that way, now the thing I'll say about the 355 ship Navy is the only way we're going to reach that, and the way the Navy has to pivot now. And they are completely interrelated, is we've got to go to a lot more uncrewed vessels, both undersea, on sea, and in the air. I mean, Ukraine has shown what unmanned surface ships can do. I mean, they've just about wiped out the Russian Black Sea Fleet with those. And so we've got to do a whole lot more of that, building more of those, smaller, cheaper, drones. And also the Navy is the only one that operates Navy and Marines in all three warfare sites, land, air, and sea. And so we can get to the 355, but we're going to have to go away from the very expensive, very complicated ships that we have now, because there are times, there weren't any times when I was secretary, but I know there have been times when we wouldn't send a carrier strike group somewhere because we were afraid we might lose it. And you can't do that. You've got to have those ships, those assets forward deployed. So that's a way longer answer than you were looking for.
I want to invite people, if you have a question for Secretary Ray Mabus, to raise your hand, either your Zoom hand or your regular hand in front of the camera, and I can unmute you. Hello, Chris. I want to thank Chris Perillo, Navy veteran, for making this program possible. You are the one, I believe. Did you meet Secretary Mabus at a conference, maybe?
Yes. Hello, Secretary Mabus. Chris Perillo, we met at last year's reunion on the deck of the Wisconsin, and later on I buttonholed you with a packet about the Veterans Breakfast Club. You said you'd get it to your people and come aboard someday, and welcome aboard. You kept your promise. Appreciate that. Don Elliott is also on the Zoom with us today, president of the Little Rock Association.
Absolutely. I know Don well, and I clearly remember when you made a very persuasive case for the Veterans Breakfast Club.
Thank you. Honored to have you here today. I have two questions for you, though. One of them we'll start off with is, I'd really like to hear the story of the Bin Laden takedown. When you were first, when you were first involved as Secretary of the Navy, where you were the night of the event, and what was the reasoning behind the burial at sea of his body? I think that'd be an interesting story to hear from your perspective.
Well, I'm going to disappoint you on the first two, because I'm still not cleared to talk about stuff.
Like understood. That. Understood.
I mean, if President Obama or somebody like that wants to talk about it, have at it. But I can't. But they were my guys. I knew every one of them that went. And I will tell you a little aside. May 1st is one of my daughter's birthdays, and May 2nd is my wife's birthday. And so Bin Laden was killed May 2nd in Pakistan, May 1st in Washington. And a couple of days later, we had a birthday dinner and had some friends. And one of my friends said, you know, most guys give jewelry for birthdays. I said, your folks just took down the most wanted terrorist on earth. What are you going to do next year? But I will tell you about the burial at sea off the Carl Vinson. That had been planned a good bit in advance, because if you had buried Bin Laden on land, we were very worried that it would become a holy site, a site for pilgrims to go to, a site for martyrs, potential martyrs to go to. And we didn't want to do that. And if there was a burial at sea, there would be no physical spot that you could go to, no marker that you could go to. And, you know, he was flown to the Vincent, his body. He was buried with, in the Islamic tradition. He was given a religious burial. We bury people at sea, off particularly our carriers, to this day. If you're a veteran and served, I don't know exactly what the process is you go through, but you can ask that your body be taken to sea and buried at sea. So that's why it was done. We just didn't want a place that people could go and be roused or, you know, made more enthusiastic or whatever.
Very good. Yes, and I understand the clearance issues there, of course. I'm sure everybody here does. Second question I have for you has to do with the Chinese Navy. They are striving to become a blue water Navy, able to go anywhere they please and do anything they want. They base that on weapons and technology. But I believe that it will take generations and generations, if they try to do that, to match the naval culture that the United States has, the expertise and the culture for sailing and naval warfare that we've developed over generations. What's your opinion in that line?
No, I absolutely agree. We talked about how the U.S. Navy pushes responsibility down very fast, very far. The Chinese Navy, and not many navies do that, but the Chinese Navy is very top heavy. You have to check, you have to go up the chain of command to check, before you do stuff. And that really handicaps any military force. I mean, you saw it particularly in the first year of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that if you don't have that culture embedded, if you're not looking to people to actually make decisions in real time on their own, and not say, Mother, may I do this? You know, and they're building a lot of ships, but I would much rather be in our position than theirs. For one of the reasons is for exactly what you said. You know, it was interesting. I took Lisa Franchetti, who was then my senior naval aide, now chief of naval operations, with me to China. And, you know, the Chinese naval folks would ask her, said, she was a surface warfare officer. She'd been a destroyer commander. She'd been a destroyer squadron commander when she went. And they said, well, did your ship have guns? You know, surely you were in charge of a hospital ship. Surely it wasn't a warship. And, you know, I thought Lisa showed amazing control not to go across the table at a couple of them. But later on, one of my, you know, I was speaking with the head of the EC fleet, and he looked at me and he said, well, because my whole team there were seven of us that went to the meetings, and three were men and four were women. And he said, we don't have to recruit women. We've got enough men. And I said, well, I think you'll find if you start recruiting women, you'll have a far better Navy. And again, a digression. My life is a digression, I think. But the next day we had a luncheon and 12 women showed up in Chinese naval uniforms. We found out that they had been given the uniforms the night before and told to come to lunch with us. But they've got that issue. They've got the issue of how good their ships are, and they're not bad. Some of their older ships are pretty terrible, but their newer ones aren't bad. The place that we've got to pay attention to is in weapons. Hypersonic, things like that, you know, you never, ever want to send our Navy or our Marines into a fair fight. We have got to keep a qualitative and quantitative edge there. I think we've got it on the Chinese now, but, you know, and this isn't going to change, and it shouldn't. But one of the things, the Chinese, they can do it faster than we can. They don't have to go through the procurement process. And, you know, particularly at the Pentagon, the procurement process will just make you lose brain cells. And it's one of the most convoluted things you've ever seen. And you really have to be innovative and figure out ways around it. But anyway, I would rather be in our position than theirs, but I'll go back to what I said before. We're going to have to develop a lot more unmanned and cheaper ships in every domain.
Thank you, sir. I hope you feel better.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Ben Wright in the chat here made a comment about the procurement process here in the U.S. Chad Riddle, another Navy veteran. How are you doing, Chad?
I'm doing well. And thank you for being on, Secretary Mavis. I'm the guy that Todd quoted about an hour ago. I also can remember getting out of the Navy, and somebody asked me, actually two guys, how'd you like the Navy? And I told, well, it was a $1 million experience. I'm glad I did it, but now it's somebody else's turn. And for the record, I got the job. But the interesting thing you said about burial at sea, I can remember participating in one. In fact, they brought the urn on board the evening before. And my question is, hey, being 22 years old, what do I do with it? And they said, keep it safe. And so I had it in the safe in my stateroom, and it was weird going to sleep that night. But the other thing, too, you said you've been on submarines. I worked with submarine rescue, and I was with the Italian Navy in the Mediterranean, went on one of their submarines. It was one of our old ones. And you probably remember the name of Admiral Flucky. It was one that was captained by him in World War II. And I came out through the submarine rescue chamber. Did you ever do any work with the deep submergence rescue vehicles, the DSRVs that have replaced the McCann rescue chamber? I'd always love to be on one of those.
Never doing what they were supposed to do. I've been in them. I went to the sub school in New London, and that 40-foot high tank of water that teaches sailors how to be rescued and how to use those lungs if they have to come up. But I've never done that. Hope none of our submariners ever have to do that. There is a book that I just finished called Strike of the Sailfish about World War II, and it was about two submarines. And the sailfish had been named Squamous before, and it sunk during a training dive off the coast of Maine. And the Sculpin had come and they saved half the crew that was in the forward part of the boat. They raised it, they redid the ship and renamed it the Sailfish. And those two submarines were sort of joined in World War II. And it's interesting book. Heartbreaking in some ways, in terms of just the incredible losses that our submariners in World War II took. But it gave you a little view into that life. I love being on. I took an attack sub, the Hampton, to the North Pole, and came up through the ice. We do a thing called ICEX every 2 years, the Navy does, and we set up a camp on the ice and we bring two submarines up. And we, and you know, they practice various things. And we have a lot of scientists there studying the ice and currents, and we have some of our special forces there. But I was underway for 6 days. Three up, three back, and I just really loved it. Of course, I was all full of myself when I got back to my office and I saw the Chief of Naval Operations, John Richardson, who was a submariner. And I told him, I said, "Wow, I was underway for 6 days." And he thought for a second and he said, "Yeah, I figured out once I've been underwater for 13 years of my life." Okay, you win.
I'm looking at the clock and hearing Secretary Mavis sneeze, realizing he's so under the weather. We have 5 more minutes with him. If you have a question, Corky, did you have your hand up? I wasn't sure. No, okay. I did want to let, oh, okay, here we go. Rich. I mean, why don't you unmute yourself, Rich?
Hey, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. I have a couple of questions for the secretary. When did you come up to Boston for the Army Navy game?
I did not, sadly.
Okay. All right. It was a great game.
I was 7-1 against Army.
Okay. The second question, have you, because I'm doing a project right now, it's the birthplace of the Navy. And one of the reasons I'm doing it is because of my experience with Todd and the group when they came up for the 225th anniversary of the Constitution. And one of the things I found that was really unbelievable was the number of Secretary of Navies that have come up to Marblehead to participate in the Navy Day / Birth of the Navy celebrations. Have you ever done that?
I never did. I'm okay. going to participate for the 250th birthday of the Navy.
You are. Okay.
In Philadelphia. Yeah. Well, and I think every living former secretary is
involved
in it in some way.
In fact, I have a couple of slides, and one of them addresses the anniversary coming up in Philadelphia, because let me say a couple of words. When Todd came up with his group on the up to Boston, when they found out I was from Beverly, oh my God, they're all over me like an old suit. And I will be very honest with you, I struggled with the answer on who was the winner. So what I've done for the last 2 years, I've gone in, I've done incredible research. I've read over 200 newspapers, old newspapers from the Marblehead Messenger and the Beverly Times. And it's just unbelievable. So what I want to do is, maybe if it's okay with you, Scott, Todd, to show a couple of slides.
Well, let's see. Let's keep that for okay. when Secretary Mavis signs off, because this is a really interesting question. When you get up to New England, there's a big debate. Was the U.S. Navy born in Marblehead or Beverly? Two towns right next to each other, and they go after it hammer and tong.
It's equivalent to the Boston Red Sox-Yankee rivalry. That's how incredible it is. But one of the things I just want to mention, the present secretary has come out, and he is elected to go to Philadelphia and do the celebration, which has caused a firestorm up here. And I mean, when I say a firestorm, it has an incredible firestorm. And Todd, I didn't want to bother you because of the Vietnam project. I was going to send you the proposal that I sent to a couple of people. And what I wanted to do is maybe do the presentation on this venue here. If I'll send it to you, you can look at it.
Okay.
But it's just it's incredible on this firestorm. And be interested on what your thoughts on that, considering all of a sudden Philly has stepped up to the plate.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I went to school after the Navy in Boston, in Cambridge. I couldn't get into Ole Miss Law School, so I had to go to Harvard. And and I became a lifelong Red Sox fan. I just didn't realize there was quite as much pain involved being a Red Sox fan when I did it. What I'll say is the Marines don't have this problem, Colonel, with Tun Tavern. They're pretty clear on where they were formed. And I've learned in politics, don't get into a debate that you're going to lose, no matter which side you come down on.
Smart man. Secretary Ray Mabus, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think you need to have a shot of whiskey and go to bed. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. I know we've just scratched the surface of your career. There are a lot of initiatives that you took as Secretary of the Navy that we didn't cover. You'd be welcome to come back anytime you'd like. We'd love to talk with you again.
Thank you. And I just want to thank everybody on here for what you've done for our country and continue to do through this. And I saw that Pat Hughes just held up his Army shirt. And, you know, except for one Saturday in December, one team, one fight.
Right. Good.
Thank y'all again. Enjoy
it very much. Take care. Thank you very much for joining us. This is great. Wonderful conversation.
Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, tobacco-free Adagio Health. Tobacco-free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco-Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco-Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org, or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco-Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco-Free Adagio Health, for your support. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt.